Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today we bring you part two of our look at the legendary ABC program, PM.
And that's all in this final edition of International. For the past 5 years, once a week in this program, we've looked at the world, at the big news events, at history in the making. We'll go on doing that. But as of next week, we'll be doing it each day, Monday to Friday. The Current Affairs Department of ABC National Radio will present PM. Each evening at 6:05, we'll look at the world, at Australia, and what's happening now. PM on the ABC second and third networks, Monday to Friday at 6:05.
PM, good evening, Hugh Evans.
Writer and broadcaster Tim Bowman was given the task of creating PM 40 years ago. As the program's first executive producer, Tim created a new form of broadcasting in Australia that used journalists to present the program as well as report live and do interviews on the run. For the first time on Australian airwaves, its journalists conducted live interviews rather than actors or announcers. PM changed the rules of broadcasting and carved its niche as the program of record. After setting up the program, Tim Bowman went on to create the current affairs television program This Day Tonight, before bowing out of broadcasting as the host of ABC Television's Back Chat. He speaks next to Edmund Roy on the early years of PM.
Firstly, tell me, this studio here, how different was it to when you started?
Light years. I wouldn't even recognise where I was. When PM first went to air in July 1969, we were working out of an old brick building in William Street called 171 William Street. And there were stone steps leading up to Upper Forbes Street, and that led up to the tower, now demolished for apartments, where the ABC studios were. Now, there were no links between there and our offices. So PM first went to air at 6:05 after the 5 o'clock news, and we had 25 minutes. And in those days, of course, it was all quarter-inch tape. And these tapes were in steel, 5-inch steel cans, which, and I can see it now, the wooden table with these laid out with the background information under each one. So you could shuffle them around and change the order. And then at about 6 o'clock, with about 5 minutes to go, because you like to keep it as late as possible to, you know, be in current affairs, to be up with the latest, poor Bill Weir, our studio producer, would pack all these tapes into his briefcase and half run up what was known as Coronary Hill.
I'm presuming he was a very fit young man.
And he wasn't. He was in late middle age, and poor old Bill, I think we probably shortened his life. But anyway, he would puff into studio 708 or 709 in the bowels of the building, and there would be a lot of replay machines, and he would thrust the tapes at the...
Has it ever been the case when the written material and the tapes were mixed up?
No, that didn't happen so often, but often the machines that the tapes were on didn't work, and that was a bit embarrassing for the compere, but we'll get onto the compares in a moment. And then these tapes would be put on, and away we'd go with the theme and introductions and what just happens today. Except that if you wanted to put something into the program, you couldn't just get on the phone and do it live to air like we do now. You had to ring up the offices down in 171 William Street, and some poor bugger would prepare something and then rush up Coronary Hill again, hopefully before 6:25, and hand it in. So the studio was primitive. And as I say, no one knows about quarter-inch tape these days, but magnetic tape, quarter-inch tape, was actually a wonderful ticket to freedom, because before that, you could not easily record in the field, and that only came in the mid-50s.
So live radio, as we know today, was not actually live.
Well, we were live to air.
Apart from the compere, that is.
Yes. Well, no, it wasn't. But it quickly became so when...
Could you do studio interviews like we're doing now?
Oh, yes. But I don't think anyone could ever find where the studio was if you ask them in. It was very well hidden away and laden with asbestos, I have to say.
Well, you survived. You survived all that. Yeah. You survived not only that, you survived actually setting up a program that was, for its time, groundbreaking.
Yes, yes. Radio in those days was pretty formal. The announcers, these produced voices, rather English in tone, were in control of the airwaves. You very seldom heard ordinary, you know, Australian voices. So the programs tended to be fronted by the announcers, or in the case of AM, which started 3 years ahead of us in 1967, by an actor, a very nice fellow and able broadcaster called Robert Peach, Bill Peach's cousin, actually. And then a succession of announcers followed him. So you had this rather formal, the same sound, as you might say. Now, AM went from 8 o'clock till 8:30, as it still does, without its early edition. And the executive producer of it was a rather feared guy called Russell Warner, who ran a pretty tight ship, and he had this draconian decree that no item was to run longer than 90 seconds. And his approach to maintaining this this ironclad policy was that if it was a bit too long, you chopped the front off and put it in the introduction. You see, that was the formula. So these things rolled through. It was a lively program, but there was a certain sameness about it. So when I got the opportunity to start PM, I was in New York for the ABC in 1968 when I was called back by Peter Hollinshead, who was then the director of current affairs in radio and television. We'd worked together in Singapore previously. And he said, you know, you come back and start this new program. Now, I went round the traps in New York, for instance. I went to one of the first all-news radio stations, WINS, part of the Westinghouse Corporation. Now, all-news radio, in a fashion, had been around in the sticks in the United States since about 1961, but WINS was the first to break the hour up into news headlines every 15 minutes, weather every 7, and breaking news as it happened, and it'll feature things sometimes as well, you know, making up the rest of the hour. And I watched this with great interest. This wasn't what we were going to do, but still it was, and it was presented, of course, by an experienced journalist who was able to react.
Was it similar in Britain?
It was, yes. The Today program, which AM, you know, was essentially a carbon copy, was fronted by a journalist. And the advantages of that was when I suddenly had to do an interview, if you feed questions to, with all the best will in the world, the announcers are very well-trained people, but there's a palpable air of phoniness about it, as they sort of, and they don't often follow up as a journalist would to a breaking story. So I was quite determined that we were going to break the mold there. I suppose what I got wrong, looking back on it, was that I didn't just choose one person. I had two journalists.
Two presenters,
John Highfield and Laurie Bryant, who was a New Zealander who was working with the ABC at the time, to alternate day and day about. Now, this was better than having the produced voice sort of start the program, but really a bit clunky. And after I left, and I was only with the program for a year because Peter Hollinshead, the director, called me across to This Day Tonight, and I became, you know, mixed up in all that, which was great fun.
This was another story entirely, yes.
Yeah, but eventually Clive Speed, who succeeded me as executive producer and really did a fantastic job, I think it must have been, yes, it was Clive who got Hugh Evans in, and Hugh did the program for, I think it was 10 or 12 years or something like that, followed by the incomparable Paul Murphy. And really, that's gone on ever since. I mean, Mark Colvin today performs that role superbly. So anyway, at least we broke the mould in that we had journalists doing it and not announcers.
You also broke the mould in actually getting journalists live to air, people who knew the subject, calling them up, getting them on air live and so on.
Yes.
That would have been, even if not a logistical exercise, even a political exercise, trying to break down the barrier, so to speak.
Well, that I suppose, came later, doing until the studios became close to the offices, and that happened after I left the program. That all became a lot easier. But, of course, I'd just like to talk about, for a few moments, if I can, the turf war that was operating in those days in the ABC. The news department was run by ex-newspaper men, and they regarded the tape recorder and what we in the trade called actuality, you know, the sounds of the world around us and voices of people actually being interviewed in stressful situations or whatever, as an instrument of the devil. So they were essentially preparing news bulletins for which even the overseas correspondents sent cables or telexes. And as a concession to the medium, they were allowed to read, rather woodenly, because they weren't trained in any way in radio techniques, a couple of sentences of that report.
So let me get this straight. So you had a foreign correspondent somewhere in some remote corner of the globe sending a report, and all he or she did was to actually read a couple of lines.
That's right. Well, they wrote the story, of course, and then selected the key couple of sentences in that story. And there sometimes, of course, wasn't time to do this. But if they were sending something in physically, and perhaps not right up to the minute, you know, they would read a couple of sentences, and that would be run instead of the announcer speaking, that you'd hear the journalist's voice. But this worried them so much that I remember a decree came out saying that no more than two voice pieces are to be in any one bulletin. So it was a pretty staid old affair. And of course, when I started PM, the Southeast Asian region and Asian region was in our time frame. So we were, and we didn't have any correspondents there. One in Singapore, that used to be me, but by then it was somebody else who was fairly hopeless, actually, but we won't go into that. And we had to, but news department had them everywhere. So Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Tokyo, and New Delhi, Saigon, but that was a bit difficult to get to live because of communications and indeed the war. So we adopted the practice of ringing these guys up and interviewing them on the phone, recording the interview, perhaps editing it a bit, and putting it to air. Well, there were a lot of these guys were just sitting there, bored shitless, because they were typing, that even if they had a scoop, they would write their story, cable it off, and the news department, if it hadn't been on the wires, the AAP or Reuters wire, they'd sit on it and wait till the wire services broke the story, and then they'd use it. So really, these guys were very, very underutilised. They were also not allowed to express, of course, any personal opinions at any stage on anything. Some might say that's a good thing. I'm sure Gerard Henderson would. But still, it was all very stilted and formed. They were effectively working like news agency people. So when we interviewed them, of course, they didn't sound so wooden. I might sound terribly wooden when I'm reading a script, although I do try, but when we're talking, there's a certain liveliness in the interview situation, indeed, as you are aware. So we were getting more use out of these guys than the news department was. And, of course, the controller of news services, who was an ex-Queensland copper called Keith Fraser, was right onto this, and he saw what was going on, and he issued this draconian decree that there would be no more interviews by the talks people. Now, I should also say that the talks department was where Current Affairs came from, but it also did religious broadcasts and feature arty programs and so on. So the news department regarded us as, you know, long-haired, suede-shoed, you know, poofters or whatever, and really not proper journalists and not to be trusted.
What was the feedback like from the public who was actually listening to these shows? Did we have a framework to understand that?
No, not really. Except that I think they probably found the Current Affairs programs a bit more lively, such as they were. But anyway, I was a bit nobbled by this because it cut off our supply of overseas news in the region. So I appealed to the head of News and Current Affairs Radio, a lovely chap named Dan Spate, Selwyn Spate, who was a former correspondent in China in World War II, and he had a bit of shrapnel in his head, actually, which sometimes sort of slowed his thought processes up a bit. But he corresponded with Fraser and said, look, you know, can we find some way around this? So Fraser issued his famous Act of God memo, which said that it was quite wrong for news journalists to be interviewed either live or not live because they might inadvertently express a personal opinion about the country that they were covering, God help us. But in cases of Act of God situations like flood, fire, famine, earthquakes, eruptions, then it would be all right to use this technique, but only if we got permission in advance from the news department. This was crazy because if we did, they'd say no, and certainly not say yes until they'd got the story themselves first. But eventually the silliness stopped and ebbed away, and ABC departments overseas were the first to be sensible about the melding of work, so that the talks guy or the news guy reported for either. I was actually trained in the newspaper, so I was allowed to report for news because I was a, quote, proper, unquote, journalist. But that all stopped, but not until long after I left the program.
You also ended up breaking a few barriers. For instance, the Commonwealth covering federal parliament, covering things about medicine, health and so on. All these archaic rules, which were sort of fell by the wayside simply because you managed to push that boundary through.
Well, we ignored a lot of them. You see, take reporting Parliament. There were all sorts of strict rules about Parliament. PM went out on what was called Radio 2, which is now Radio National, but it only went to the capital cities and Canberra. And when Parliament was on, we weren't on the air at all. Although luckily, I think PM came in the dinner break or something, so we still got to air. But Parliament just broadcast on by law all day. You could not record Parliament. You know how Question Time these days, you'll have bits of it replayed in the television news. We weren't allowed to record a word that was said on the service that the ABC was providing, and there were all kinds of laws about what was proper in terms of the dignity of Parliament. Satire was unheard of, although even in the late 60s, the State Tonight was sort of doing its bit in that department, and nothing happened. So Paul Murphy, who was our correspondent in Canberra when PM started, used to do these wonderful word pictures of what was actually going on in the House of Assembly. John Gorton was the Prime Minister at the time, and he was a fairly colourful fella, and Paul would, with acerbic humour sometimes, and brilliant word pictures of what was going on, and people loved it, you know. And of course, everyone does it now, but you know, he was the first to do it. That was one thing. Another silly thing was the health department rules. Now, from time immemorial, God knows how long this had been going on, any story that the ABC did on health matters had to be cleared by the health department. And they might take their time. They might take, you know, 24 hours or a week or something. And you could not use that material until they'd said yay or nay, in which case you couldn't. So we just said that's silly and we ignored it and no one ever did anything. So, things like that. And we also tried to make it fun. It was more of a magazine program when it first started than it is today. This is something that Clive Speed, every executive producer, even today, would put their stamp on the program to a certain extent. And Clive made it a harder-edged, more political program. We certainly covered the main stories, but I used to like to sneak in, good radio, because you weren't hearing it. You weren't hearing it anywhere else. And one example of that was that I put Paul Raphael onto the Royal Tour of 1970. Everyone was here, the Queen, Duke of Edinburgh, Charles, Princess Anne, and Paul is a very, very good reporter and somewhat of a loose cannon, I have to say. He went to the showground where the royals were going, and the cars pulled up one by one. And Paul, being Paul, stayed behind a bit. And the fourth car, the last one that drew up, had Princess Anne in it. And as she got out, the wind blew up her skirt, and she said, bloody hell, and smoothed it down, and off she went. Well, Paul reported that, you see. It's a good story. But the royal reporters from England who were, who had all these rules and regulations that Paul didn't know anything about, wouldn't have cared anyway, about what royals never swore. And there was also this cozy club which decreed, you know, what went out about the royals.
I'd venture to suggest they still have that kind of club.
I'm sure that, well, probably it's fragmenting these days with knowing Fleet Street, but all hell broke loose. And Paul was berated by one Fleet Street journalist saying, you made it up, you know. But anyway, it was, and of course, these guys were getting phone calls or cables saying, you know, where's the story? Why haven't you got the story? But that was good fun. So we tried to have a feeling of adventure about the program, because it was an exciting time. We were doing new things, and I think the audience realised that. And it was a bigger audience than the audience for AM, the morning program, because unbeknownst to me, some programmer in the ABC had very kindly put us on what was called the third network, which meant it went out to the bush. All the big country towns, you know, the Tamworths and Bunburys and all that sort of... And we had transmitters then, you know, all over the country. So we got... And these people used to get nothing in terms of current affairs. They didn't get AM. And we got these letters from all these grateful, I mean, not everyone in the bush is a farmer. They have university towns and God knows what, saying, thank God we've got this, we're hearing something about what's going on in the world. And AM woke up to what was going on, and they also switched. Eventually we were both switched to the first network, which, you know, put us out on this wider grid. So that was a bit of luck. So we made our mark right from the start, Edmund.
Let's look at the future now. What do you see happening? You know, you've got the web, you've got PM, you've got AM, you've got the World Today, you've got News Radio, you've got several networks. There's so much of news happening 24/7. What's next?
Well, of course, everything has to be instantly available, and I think there are some traps in this. We certainly, as foreign correspondents, and you would know about this. We had time to, or maybe you didn't, because I think the technology had caught up with you, but you had time to think. You could say to your bosses, look, I'll be away. I'm going with Marcos down into the islands, southern islands of the Philippines, and I'll report back in 4 days. Well, that now is just not on. And the poor old correspondent, I will come back to your question, but does everything. I mean... The guy in Afghanistan or the woman in Afghanistan, like guys are, it's all right to say guy, isn't it? It's a cross-platform. That's fine. But anyway, the reporter will have to take pictures, will have to write the script, do radio, and then be on call on his or her mobile phone to be woken up at any hour of the day or night. They can't possibly keep abreast of everything that's going on. So sometimes they have to, and often have to be briefed by head office from the wider picture that the reporter doesn't have access to, in order to be able to do a suitably cogent report. And I think that is a terrible strain on people, not being able to perhaps have a good night's sleep if a story is really breaking, that can, you know, cause difficulties. And the sort of errors that Keith Fraser was on about when he said his journalist might inadvertently express, you know, a personal opinion. I'm not all, and of course there's people pod things, they can call it up again on the web if they've missed the program. So all that is happening. Where's it going to go from there? Well, I think it's there. I mean, I can't see anything else much that's going to happen. I mean, it is extraordinary that PM is still going after 40 years, and indeed AM. But changes took place. I mean, we went from 25 minutes to 50 minutes, which I initially was a bit worried whether it could be sustained at the pace that it was. Oh, by the way, we didn't do 90-second stories. I mean, we would throw even in 1969, we would throw the whole program over, or three quarters of it, to a breaking story, with different segments, of course.
Well, here's to another 40 years. Thank you.
Thanks, Edmund.
That was Edmund Roy speaking to writer and broadcaster Tim Bowden, who created the program PM for the ABC. Well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect and what's been happening. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith, the global HF propagation forecast from IPS in Australia. Normal at all latitudes through January 16th. From Space Weather South Africa through January 16th, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. Radio Society of Great Britain calls for maximum usable frequencies up to 21 MHz on DX paths during daylight, with occasional openings on the higher HF bands. From Met Office UK through January 16th, solar activity low or very low, with a 30% chance of common class flares. Solar radiation storms are not expected. From Peter Coleman, OK1MGW of the Czech Propagation Interested Group, the geomagnetic field will be mostly quiet on January 15th to 17th, 23rd and 31st. Quiet on January 18th and 19th, 24th to 26th. Quiet to unsettled January 20th to 22nd, 29th, 30th, and February 3rd. Quiet to active January 27th, 28th, February 1st and 2nd. From Space Weather Canada, the 27-day magnetic activity forecast shows highest nanotesla DRX readings on January 22nd and 23rd, February 2nd and 3rd. From the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, solar activity very low to low, January 11th to 14th, and 29th to February 6th. From January 15th to 28th, activity levels are expected to increase to low to moderate levels. Geomagnetic field unsettled to active January 22nd, 23rd, 28th, 29th, and February 2nd and 3rd, with isolated minor G1 storm levels likely January 18th. ANK indices peaking at 15 and 4 on January 22nd, 18 and 5 on January 28th. Lowest indices of 5 and 2 on January 18th to 20th and 24th to 27th. Solar flux varying little, within 5 units above or below 105. William Hepburn's worldwide VHF, UHF microwave DX forecasts show strong tropospheric ducting off Baja California and as far north as San Francisco. Extreme ducting off the coast of Uruguay and southern Brazil, January 17th to 19th. And all week along the west and northwest coasts of Australia.
Thanks, Glenn. And that's all we have time for on this edition of the program. Our email address is, as always, mnp@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you again very soon. Goodbye, 73 and 88 to the ladies.